The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It is possible, depending on what happens in November in the election, that some of these cases could be mooted. I don't think they'll be mooted merely by the expiration of the current Congress, because the controversies could be revisited again in the next Congress, and I don't think they will be determined to lapse. Although there is case law that suggests that the House is not a continuing body. That is, when it adjourns sine die at the end of a Congress, it goes out of existence. And there has been some litigation over whether previously issued subpoenas survive the adjournment sine die of the previous Congress. Not so in the Senate, which is a continuing body. So that undoubtedly, mootness will undoubtedly be an issue regardless of what the outcome of the election is.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 11th, 2020. I sat down with Stan Brand, who served as the general counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives from 1976 to 1983. We first talked with Stan on the podcast way back in January of 2019, when Democrats took control of the House. A lot has happened since then. Stan and I talked about key issues working their way through the courts that could redefine congressional subpoena power and congressional oversight for a generation. How will these cases move forward in light of the COVID-19 pandemic? How might they be decided, and what might that mean for the future of congressional power? And what impact are these cases having on congressional oversight right now? It's the Lawfare Podcast, Stan Brand, on the state of congressional oversight and subpoena power. So, Stan, the last time you were on the podcast was way back on January 29th, 2019. I re-listened to that podcast. You talked about congressional subpoenas, executive privilege, civil enforcement of congressional subpoenas. And it almost, you know, listening to it now, it almost sounded quaint because so much has happened in this space on enforcement of congressional subpoenas, you know, congressional oversight generally. So let's just dive right into it. Let's start with the McGahn case, which to me is sort of a seminal case. Why don't you give our listeners sort of a roundup or review of where the McGahn case is and what your thoughts are on it?
Yes, the McGahn case was a congressional subpoena to Don McGahn, former White House counsel, in connection with the Judiciary Committee inquiry into the president's conduct. McGahn had, as you recall, testified for, I think, something like 28 or 29 hours to the independent counsel, Robert Mueller, and then the committee followed up and wanted to either depose him or have him in a hearing. He moved to quash, as did the White House counsel that joined him, or the Justice Department, asserting that his testimony was privileged, given his close proximity to the president and his role as counsel. The committee was authorized and went to court to enforce that subpoena. It wended its way finally to the Court of Appeals and a three-judge panel, which is the typical way that these things are first heard in the Court of Appeals. And there was a 2-1 decision with just Judge Griffith, who ironically used to be the Senate legal counsel, holding essentially that these are what lawyers call non-justiciable questions, that that these cases of direct lawsuits between the president and Congress are not within the Constitution's Article III case or controversy requirement, because they are between the political branches who have ample power and authority to joust with each other, and that to draw the courts into this is not something that was envisioned by the Constitution. And so the case was dismissed. The next thing that happened was the House, unhappy with that result, as you can imagine, petitioned for rehearing. And what typically happens is the petitioner will petition for rehearing with a suggestion for rehearing en banc. That is, the full circuit court of appeals comprised of however many judges there are now, 10, 11. That was granted. And the 2-1 panel decision was vacated, which is typically the case. And so the full court of appeals will hear the case again in what we call, lawyers call, de novo. They will rehear it, it'll be re-argued, and they will make a final decision.
And just to go back to the sort of moment when the D.C. Circuit decided the case the way it did on jurisdictional grounds, were you surprised by that? Was it something that was unexpected from your point of view as someone who follows these cases closely?
No, I wasn't surprised. My own view of it is that it's wrongly decided, that this Court of Appeals has decided Congress versus the president disputes over documents in prior years, most notably during the Watergate era, when they decided the Senate Select Committee case against President Nixon for copies of the tapes. The court reached the merits in that decision, and the court reached the merits in a earlier decision when former Congressman John Moss attempted to get national security wiretaps from AT&T, and the court just took jurisdiction of that case. But no, it didn't surprise me, given the Justice Department's current position, that the courts just don't have jurisdiction to hear these types of cases. This is a position they've been pushing with vigor over the last several years, decade.
And so it seems that, you know, in this instance, at least the panel, you know, two judges on the panel sort of almost took that position, took the side of the Justice Department. I was struck in those opinions, though, the suggestion that this notion of absolute immunity, which was sort of the substantive issue at stake of whether Don McGahn was absolutely immune from having to go up and testify at all, having to show up, there was this sort of suggestion that on the part of a couple of the judges that was likely not consistent with law. Well, what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, that's not atypical. That's the court drawing a dividing line between what we call the merits and the jurisdiction of the court to hear the case to begin with. And, you know, jurisdiction as a matter of federal jurisprudence is a requirement in every case. Article 3 grants federal courts jurisdiction over those class of cases that they are required to hear. And they have to make that determination in every case, even in those cases where they make it very quickly or easily, and those like this case where they have to go into some detail to explain why.
And as you said, the D.C. Circuit is set to hear this case en banc. I think it's still scheduled for April 24th, notwithstanding the sort of difficulties many of the courts are encountering with physical distancing, et cetera. Is that right? It's still scheduled for the 24th?
I believe so, although it's not clear to me whether the courts are going to actually go through with that. But yeah, I think it's still on the docket.
And so if it does go forward, I mean, based on your experience arguing these cases in court, you know, what will that look like if it's sort of a virtual hearing? Give us a sense for what you think that will actually be like.
Well, going back to ancient history, when I was counsel to the House, I argued several en banc decisions before the D.C. Circuit, one involving a challenge to the House chaplaincy. And although oral arguments are almost Talmudic sometimes in their appearance to outsiders or laymen, there can be a lot of drama. There can be a lot of back and forth. There can be heated back and forth between the lawyers and even among the judges on the circuit. Well, it's hard to have that when everybody's by remote. It won't lessen the intellectual focus of the hearing, and it probably won't change the dynamic of the judges interrupting the lawyers and the lawyers having to live within the time constraints that they're under, but it will lack some of the drama and some of the immediacy that you have when you're doing it in the court.
Will that be open to the public? Like, will there be a way for the public to, you know, observe that?
My guess would be yes. Normally, of course, these are open to the public. And in some instances, in the Court of Appeals, in highly controversial or publicly charged cases, they will have an overflow room where they will pipe in the audio from the argument. My guess is because the courts aren't used to having to deal with this, they're going to have to come up with some technology to provide that. But my guess is they will try to do that.
And then, so just getting back to the merits, before we leave the McGann case, what's your read of how the D.C. Circuit en banc will decide this case?
Well, it's going to be very interesting because I don't know what the split is among the active judges who will be in the en banc argument, but it will be interesting to see the alignments between the democratically appointed judges and the Republican appointed judges, because we've already had some pretty strong dissents and some separate opinions from some of the judges on each side of that divide. So it'll be very interesting to see. Again, I think the hurdle for the Justice Department is these two previous cases I've mentioned where this circuit has gotten to the merits of such disputes. And whether they will be able to distinguish those sufficiently will be, I think, what the conservatives will be trying to muster the votes for.
So let's move to what I would consider maybe better news for Congress, a different case. This has to do with the House Judiciary Committee's access to grand jury materials referenced in the Mueller report. You know, as you do with the McGann case, why don't you kind of give us a bit of the background and your views on sort of where this case is headed?
Yes. There was a lengthy grand jury investigation by independent special counsel Robert Mueller, which produced a voluminous set of records, some of which were referenced in the public report or the reports that ultimately became public, and some of it which remained redacted, that is, blacked out. And some of which is within the archives of the grand jury and not been revealed to anyone other than the special counsel's office. In an effort to get at some of those materials, not all of them, but certain materials related to aspects of the Mueller report that the committee was interested in following up on, they requested the grand jury materials. The department objected, and this went to a district court, which found for the committee, and then ultimately to the Court of Appeals, which in a 2-1 decision found that these records were available to the Congress under an exception in the secrecy rules that govern grand juries for materials preliminary to a judicial proceeding. And this is another echo from Watergate, where the grand jury in the Watergate case provided the so-called roadmap to the House Judiciary Committee considering the impeachment of President Nixon and gave them access to certain of the grand jury materials. The prevailing rule in this circuit determined during the Watergate era in a case involving Haldeman basically held that the House was entitled to the exception for judicial proceedings because impeachment, unlike legislative work, was more like a judicial proceeding than anything else. And the courts quoted the terms of art used in the Constitution that make it more akin to a judicial proceeding than a typical legislative proceeding. The Justice Department has taken objection to that, and it remains to be seen what will happen next in that case, but my guess is it too will go en banc.
And Judge Griffith, he is on both of these cases, the McGann case and this grand jury case. So, you know, walk us through how he decided, it seems like in almost in Congress's favor in this one, but, you know, to deny jurisdiction in the other one. Walk us through some of the differences between these cases and how they have seemingly turned out differently.
The central difference, and the one relied on by Judge Griffith in the grand jury case, was this notion that the grand jury is more akin or more closely supervised by the judicial branch than any of the other branches, that these are, in effect, judicial records.
Right, even though they're in the possession of the Justice Department.
They can be. Sometimes they're actually in possession of the clerk or the court, or they're consigned to the archives as custodian, but they're really under control of the judges. And in his view, this was a critical and dispositive distinction, which allowed him to distinguish that case from the McGann case. And so he came down on the side of allowing the committee to get these records.
So you said you think it will probably go en banc. Do you know what sort of when we'll know that?
I'm not sure. I'm sure the time may have run for requesting a delay of the mandate to seek review at the en banc level. I haven't read anything, so I don't know whether the department has pressed forward on that or what has actually happened.
So before we move on to the cases that are currently before the Supreme Court, I want to just briefly talk about the status of one that hasn't gotten as much press, I think. It's this case by the House Ways and Means Committee against the Treasury Department to produce copies of the president's federal tax returns, and it involves, you know, statute. This is, you know, obviously an important issue. It's very timely. The elections is coming up. What's sort of the status of this case? What's holding it up?
Well, that's stuck on idle in the district court. And the reason why it's stuck on idle in the district court is because of the McGann case. And the district judge that's presiding over the Treasury case, the subpoena from Ways and Means for the president's tax records, basically read the McGann case and said, well, I have to consider now whether I have jurisdiction to decide this dispute. And so I really want to wait until we hear from the full circuit before I make that decision. And I think both sides have agreed to hold that in abeyance until we get a result in the McGann case.
It strikes me that all of the time that it is taking to have these cases move through the courts, I mean, do you think it's possible that a lot of this will be essentially mooted because decisions won't be made before the end of this Congress?
It could be. This is one of the things that we talked about back in 2019, which was that the length of time it takes, and I should say, this is what litigation is, and people are frustrated. I'm sure the House is frustrated with the pace of litigation. But once you go into court, you go into their realm, and their realm is controlled by detailed development of the facts and detailed development of the law. And so it takes time. It is possible, depending on what happens in November in the election, that some of these cases could be mooted. I don't think they'll be mooted merely by the expiration of the current Congress, because the controversies could be revisited again in the next Congress, and I don't think they will be determined to lapse. Although there is case law that suggests that the House is not a continuing body. That is, when it adjourns sine die at the end of a Congress, it goes out of existence. And there has been some litigation over whether previously issued subpoenas survive the adjournment sine die of the previous Congress. Not so in the Senate, which is a continuing body. So that undoubtedly, mootness will undoubtedly be an issue regardless of what the outcome of the election is.
So let's move on to the three Supreme Court cases that are have actually been joined together. So this is the Mazars case, and we've covered the Mazars case a fair amount on this podcast and on the Lawfare website. So our listeners and readers will be pretty familiar with it. That is a DC Circuit decision. And then there's two other cases, both from the Second Circuit. One is the Deutsche Bank and Capital One case, which is similar to the Mazars case in that it was, you know, a congressional committee seeking financial and tax records from the president's personal or, you know, company and personal accountants. And then there's also a Manhattan DA Mazars case. So give us your view on this in particular, if you would, how you see the Supreme Court, you know, why they decide to take these three cases, join them together. What do you think they're going to decide, or how are you thinking about predicting the future on that?
Well, again, I don't think it's a surprise that the Supreme Court would accept certiorari on these cases, if for no other reason than they involve a sitting president of the United States. And you'll recall during the Clinton era, President Clinton was subpoenaed for a deposition in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case, all of the facts of which arose prior to becoming president. And he made actually some of the same claims that are echoed by the Trump lawyers, which is not that the president can never be deposed or his records can never be subpoenaed, but that they should be deferred, that request, that subpoena should be deferred while he's sitting to be taken up at a later time after he's left office. And that was the plea that Clinton made, or his lawyers made, to the Supreme Court in the Paula Jones case, which was, I believe, unanimously rejected. And the court said there's nothing in our prior case law or in the Constitution that would immunize a president from being deposed in a civil lawsuit having nothing to do with his official duties that arose prior to the time of his election. And so he was ultimately deposed. And as we recall, that ultimately sowed the seeds for his impeachment on allegations that he lied under oath in a civil case regarding his relationship to Monica Lewinsky. Some of these same issues are presented in the Trump subpoenas. And what the Trump lawyers are arguing is that a president is absolutely immune while he is president from any process, civil or criminal, and that this all should be deferred and pushed off until he's out of office. The district attorney case, the Cy Vance case, has a slightly different nuance to it because it emanates from a state authority. The state authority is attempting to get the tax records for purposes of determining whether violations of state tax or other laws have been violated. And that isn't on all fours with the Jones case. So that one may go off on a very different and very narrow ground of federal courts deferring from enjoining state investigations by state prosecutors. So there's a range of possibilities there with two of them going off on the broader issue and one of them going off on a much narrower issue.
And so, you know, I've heard other scholars and lawyers out there saying, gee, you know, depending on how these cases are decided, maybe in particular, as you say, the Deutsche Bank and the Mazars case, that not the Cy Vance case, the other Mazars case, you know, this could change the functioning and the standards of congressional oversight for, you know, a generation. So do you think that's true? Do you think the stakes are that high? And what do you think is going to happen, or how do you think about what the consequences might be?
No question that this grouping of cases is the most significant jurisprudential development in the area of congressional investigative power in the last 30 years. And as I explain to my students in the course that I teach on congressional investigative power, these cases are episodic. They are incidental to and part of national scandals. Whether we go to Teapot Dome in 1926 or Watergate in 1974 or Bill Clinton in 1998 or now President Trump in 2020, These cases are monumental nerve center constitutional cases that arise out of national crisis and national confrontation between the Congress and the president or among the branches. So depending on what the court ultimately will say and which courts that will be, because again, remember, the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is for the most part discretionary. It's up to the court to decide which cases to take, and they often take some and not others in these types of confrontations. In fact, in the Watergate era, they took the Nixon tapes case from the special prosecutor because it was needed in the trial of White House defendants, but they did not take the case in the subpoena for the tapes by the Senate Select Committee on Watergate, and they let the Court of Appeals decision become the law of the circuit, as we say. And so that could happen here. They could let some of these stand and not take them. But to the extent we get even courts of appeals decisions and or Supreme Court decisions, we could have a major, major recasting of the balance of power in the separation of powers between the president and the Congress, depending on what the court says. So, for example, in the McGahn case, were the Supreme Court or the full en banc circuit to ratify the panel decision that they have no jurisdiction to decide these kinds of disputes, that would essentially shut down congressional oversight of presidential and maybe even agency decisions, because the Congress would simply have no way of enforcing its subpoenas. It's been stymied with its use of the Congressional Contempt Statute 2 United States Code 192, which provides a mechanism for referral to the U.S. attorney in the district for enforcement of those subpoenas. It's a criminal process. The department has steadfastly refused under both Democratic and Republican administrations to use that statute against executive officials asserting privilege on behalf of the president. And so if a civil lawsuit is not possible and a criminal referral is not possible, then Congress is left whistling in the wind. And without some enforcement mechanism, is at the mercy of the president's claims of privilege.
Although, you know, I think there are certainly these judges and also sort of critics out there who would say, no, the way that Congress enforces its subpoenas or vindicates its interests is it uses its own constitutional powers, the appropriations power, the power to, you know, confirm certain types of officials in the executive branch. They would say, no, like those are the right tools for Congress to use to vindicate its interests. What do you think of that argument?
Those undoubtedly are effective tools. They could be effective tools. They've been threatened over time. They are not effective because it requires the government essentially to come to a stop. So if the Congress would flex its muscles by saying, we're not going to appropriate any money, we're not going to confirm any officials, we're not going to do the other things that we are, you know, delegated to do within the Constitution, that would have dire consequences in our system. And it's also one that is virtually impossible to get through a bicameral legislature in this instance, which is split between Democratic and Republican control. So yes, as a theoretical textual matter, the Congress could rise up on its hind legs and invoke those. My view is highly impractical, highly unlikely that that would be a real threat.
So Stan, I just have to ask, because you did serve as general counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives from 1976 to 1983, what do you think of the notion of, you know, Congress essentially sending out the sergeant at arms to arrest people who are defying subpoenas and putting them in some room in the Capitol?
Yes, and I interestingly raised that possibility myself when I was general counsel and we were investigating the EPA under the auspices of then Administrator Ann Gorsuch, ironically the mother of the current Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And when we were thwarted in various and sundry ways by the Department of Justice, I explored the possibility of using inherent contempt, and people felt that was a potentially unseemly and inappropriate way to enforce congressional subpoenas. Although there is no question legally that that is one way you could enforce your subpoenas. And even Judge Griffith in his decision recognized that arresting a witness and hauling them before the House or Senate would be a justiciable controversy because you've attached the person and you have a procedure called habeas corpus where that person can challenge the constitutionality of the attachment. Now, in light of what that looks like as a matter of appropriateness or decorum, it's unlikely that anyone would actually spend any time in jail, because what would happen is the lawyers, and I thought about doing this in the House with authorization if I got it, I would call the lawyers from the other side and I would tell them, we're sending the sergeant in arms to arrest the administrator. Go to court, get a habeas petition, and we'll march off and figure out who has the right to these documents and this testimony. And so it would be a much more orchestrated way. Now, in the old days, I have to say, it wasn't so orchestrated. In fact, the McGrane v. Daugherty case, which is a landmark case from 1926 that established for the first time the broad parameters of congressional investigative power, that's exactly what happened. The Senate sent out the sergeant at arms to arrest Mally Daugherty, the brother of the attorney general who had refused to come and produce bank records, and hauled him in front of the Senate. I guess before he got there, he went to district court in Ohio and he got a habeas petition granted. And that's how the case arrived at the Supreme Court. So it is clearly a legal and constitutional way to determine the outcome. It's just not one that we're used to seeing. The House hasn't, or the Senate hasn't exercised that in probably 90 years.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if, depending on how the en banc case in the D.C. Circuit for on the McGahn case goes, you know, maybe potentially we could see that, some sort of an action. When you describe it, it sounds rather civil. I was thinking it was a little bit more, you know, sort of physical and kind of crazy. But what you're describing is seems to be a much more, you know, just it's sort of what lawyers do in the day to day rather than really sending out the sergeant at arms to like physically get someone.
Yeah, there's no mystery about the use of the habeas proceeding in our system. It's been used for hundreds of years. In fact, when President Lincoln suspended habeas during the Civil War, there was a hue and cry in the Congress about whether he had the authority to do that, something that wasn't really resolved until after the war. So it's in our system, it's there. In modern times, it has been disfavored, but it could be used, and there could be a path to getting a judicial resolution without the drama or a minimization of the drama that we associate with arresting someone.
Just to go back to the three Supreme Court cases, I know that they were, I think, scheduled to be argued on March 31st, but that was put off because of the COVID-19 pandemic. What's the sort of the latest of what you're hearing on how the Supreme Court is going to handle those cases and sort of other cases that are coming? They're supposed to be decided, you know, by the Supreme Court this term.
Right. That typically would be decided at the end of June when they release all their opinions and go off on recess till October. That schedule has been thrown into disarray because of the cancellation of arguments. I'm not quite sure how the court is going to handle the rest of the term. And beyond that, I know that they are meeting via conference on the rest of their agenda, I think they're finished scheduling arguments for this term, but they are meeting in conference via remote. So their business is continuing. I guess the question will be, how much oral argument are we going to get? Now, the other thing that's been raised by some scholars is there's no requirement that these cases be orally argued. They could be decided on the papers, as we say. That's not generally done in the Supreme Court in cases like these. There are some summary affirmances and summary reversals. Those are not the general order of the day.
So if you had to choose, I mean, as between the, you know, Supreme Court finding a way for there to be an oral argument or having them decide it on just on the papers, it seems like having them decide it on the papers would be a quicker resolution. If the time is sort of running on this, you know, what would be your sort of preference about how the court should move forward?
On the one hand, you could certainly expect full consideration, even on the papers. As again, I tell my students, oral argument is a very rarefied event. And most of these judges come to the bench with a fully developed view of the case. They've read the briefs. They understand the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. They probably have a view. It's rare, I think, that an advocate changes anyone's mind. What I think the advocacy does do is shape the nature of the outcome. It affects the case around the edges, where judges decide on what basis they're going to decide something, how narrowly, how widely, and the compromises and trade-offs that they make with each other in the privacy of the conference to arrive at a decision. That, I think, it could be affected by the lack of oral argument, because that's where some of that gets played out with the advocates. So I always prefer to have the argument on nerve center cases like this, which go to the heart of the power of the Congress to conduct oversight. It may be that you waive it in this case. And in the case of the New York lawsuits that have been accepted for cert, I'd be more likely to do that, because I think the assertion that the president is absolutely immune while he's president from civil lawsuits having nothing to do with his duties is a dead letter after Jones v. Clinton. So I'd be willing to submit those on the papers.
So I want to ask you about, I know you are in private practice, you represent people who are involved in these sorts of civil enforcement matters. What has been the impact of these cases moving through the system, you know, the outcome of the McGann case with no jurisdiction? What has been the impact that you're seeing with respect to, for example, private persons who are the recipients? I mean, Don McGann, I guess, technically is a private person, although he's a former employee. But what has been, have you seen any impact sort of more generally about how lawyers are thinking about this space for private individuals who are the subject of a congressional subpoena?
Yeah, I think the effect here, and it's an effect we witnessed after Watergate, is what I call the emperor has no clothes effect. So if you're a private party, and you are the subject of a congressional investigation, you're getting subpoenas, and you're worried about various exposures that giving the records might create, or confidentiality claims, or private litigation that could be fomented by your public position in the committee, you're beginning to look at these cases and say, well, if this is good enough for the president and his executive branch agencies, maybe it's good enough for me. Maybe I should test the water. Maybe I should object and force the Congress to try to enforce these subpoenas. It engenders an attitude of recalcitrance among the lawyers and the parties representing them, and can spawn progeny, even in the private sphere, much the way the Nixon cases in Watergate spawned litigation and attacks against the government in wiretapping cases, in individual rights cases, and in all types of litigation where the federal government was the defendant. Even in the Congress, I saw this as general counsel, where people and lawyers who have never thought of challenging the Congress in a direct way considered doing it based on the breakdown in comity and deference that occurred when the Supreme Court and other courts held that the president wasn't absolutely immune from certain types of enforcement actions and certain types of lawsuits. So, yeah, I think it creates an atmosphere of challenge. And the more people see that as an opening, the more they will attempt to exploit it for their own interests.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And it doesn't bode well for the future of congressional oversight, frankly, if all that plays out the way you are seeing it play out. I want to move to a much more here and now. I think of this as future court cases, if there is jurisdiction to consider it. So as you know, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which is shortened as the CARES Act, was signed into law by President Trump on March 27th. It commits over $2 trillion to efforts to blunt the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States. It's, I think, the most expensive piece of stimulus legislation in our history. There were a few mechanisms created in that bill for oversight of how the executive branch is going to spend that massive amount of money. You want to walk us through those and sort of what your view is of these various mechanisms?
Yes, this is the so-called signing statement, which is usually a celebratory ceremonial statement that the president signs, which accompanies the passage enactment, final enactment of a statute. What has grown up, I think, since FDR is this practice of objecting to certain provisions that Congress has passed, nevertheless signing the legislation and then contesting the constitutionality of some of these provisions as an afterthought. There's three basic provisions in the act which would involve Congress to some degree. One is the Council of Inspectors General on Integrity and Efficiency, who will be selecting the executive director and the deputy director of this new Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, is told in the legislation, the president is told to consult with Congress about this. And he's objected to that on a variety of grounds, essentially saying that that interferes in his Article II, take care that the laws be faithfully executed power. The second objection to the second provision is one that requires the inspector general, the newly appointed SIGPR, as it's known, Special Inspector General for Pandemic Recovery, to inform Congress without delay of any unreasonable refusal of an executive agency to provide information to the IG. The president has asserted that Congress cannot require an IG to report to Congress, in his words, without presidential supervision, which he maintains would impair his take care responsibility. To me, these are excessively broad interpretations of the take care clause, and I don't think have validity, but there they are.
That one would seem to, I mean, when you talk about it, it seems the name Michael Atkinson comes to mind, who's the Inspector General for the intelligence community, who was essentially just fired by Trump for essentially, you know, making Congress aware or setting in motion the steps to make Congress aware that there was activity going on that did eventually lead to impeachment.
Right, which the statute provided he was to do. And remember, this all goes back to the Inspector General Act of 1978, which has a bunch of reporting provisions in it, which have never seriously been contested. There have been skirmishes over them from time to time between the department and the Congress, but no president, to my knowledge, has ever laid down a marker as strictly as this one to say, I'm simply not going to pay any attention to these. And to me, they fly in the face of some case law, including case law that the Department of Justice has relied on, where the Congress exercised the so-called legislative veto, which was struck down by the Supreme Court because it didn't require bicameral passage and presentment to the president. Well, this is sort of the flip side of that. The Take Care Clause requires the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed as written by Congress. And so he may not like them. His choice is to sign them or veto them, not to arrogate unto himself the power to decide that they are null and void. And in fact, there's a case, Clinton versus the City of New York from 1998, where the court struck down the line item veto that the Congress had provided to the president. And what did they do in striking that down but rely on the Chadha case, the One House veto case, and said, quote, in both legal and practical effect, the president has amended two acts of Congress by repealing a portion of each. Repeal of statutes no less than enactment must conform with the requirements of Article II, that is bicameral passage and presentment. So if you turn the president's argument against him, you'd see that he's on, I think, very weak constitutional ground. But again, what are the remedies for that?
Right. How does it actually get into court to get decided?
How does it get into court? Does it get into court? Now, the interesting part of this is, and this goes back to Judge Griffith, the court drew a distinction there between actions directly between the Congress and the president and actions by private citizens, which the court has allowed. So you'll remember from history the famous Steele seizure case, where President Truman, without statutory authority, relying on his inherent Article II power as commander-in-chief, ordered the seizure of the steel mills during the Korean War because of a threatened strike, so that we'd still be able to build tanks and aircraft during the war. And the court struck down the president's ability to do that. Well, what makes that case different is that where a private party is injured in the traditional way in which courts remedy private wrongs of citizens, there is jurisdiction. And you could see maybe someone, there's some plaintiff out there that could be harmed by one of these provisions not being enforced that would allow them to get into court. But that's not a foregone conclusion.
Right. Maybe, you know, one business gets some recovery money, another doesn't, and maybe the one that doesn't could be found to have standing.
Or one gets investigated by the inspector general and claims some type of, you know, political interference or excessive use of the statutory powers of the inspector general and somehow gets into court.
And this Congressional Oversight Commission in the CARES Act, any thoughts on that?
Well, again, it's not unprecedented because as part of the 2008 bailout during the financial crisis, there was an inspector general for reviewing that those actions. There was an inspector general, special inspector general for Iraq. These are mechanisms that Congress has now put in place to try to oversee, because you have billions of dollars being doled out, and that's just an invitation for fraud, waste, and abuse. As one former inspector general colleague of mine, Earl Devaney, who was the TARP inspector general, was quoted as very recently saying, this is a honeypot. This is like putting out a honeypot, and you have to have a strong enforcement mechanism to keep people from victimizing that fund and misusing the federal dollars.
Yeah, I suspect you will be using this as a teaching tool going forward in your classes, depending on how it all unfolds.
Yes, because we live in a time when all of a sudden a lot of these separation of powers issues, which are dormant or asleep for decades, have come roaring back, although they appear to become coming back with increasing frequency. I mentioned, you know, we had Teapot Dome in 26, and then we waited till Watergate, really, to get the next explosion of this type of litigation. Well, now, in 1998, we had another set, and now we have another. So they seem to be getting closer in time. We seem to be fragmenting more on our separation of powers questions than we have maybe at any other time in history.
And in your view, Stan, why do you think that is?
I think there's a breakdown in respect for government. There is increasing disputation between the branches, between the political parties. You have split control, where you have split control and very closely aligned elections. You have more potential for dispute and argumentation over who should have the power and to what extent. And so it's all part of a piece, it seems to me, of what's happened over the last couple of decades. And it is now expressing itself, or it's finding its way into the courts.
I think that's probably right. And I just ask you a final question. I know you teach law at Penn State. How's that going? I assume you're teaching remotely. How are the students adjusting to this sort of new atmosphere we're all living in?
It's going phenomenally well. And you know, I'm old and I'm not of the technology era, so it took me a bit of adjustment. But I have to say, the student response has been really terrific. I don't know what it is about the technology that creates almost more intimacy and more openness to question and exchange. I'm getting even more interaction with my students over the Zoom than I oftentimes get in class, where I guess there's an intimidation factor, you know, the old professor standing up giving the wisdom. And here it's much more of an equalizing medium, and it's more of a conversation, which for me as a professor is ideal, because that's what you want. That's where the stretching and the growth comes in learning, I think, particularly with the law, is in that in those interactions and in that exchange. So I think it's going to revolutionize not just business and everything else. I think it's going to revolutionize teaching.
Well, I have very much enjoyed having this personal interaction here, and I feel like I've gotten, you know, a download from a very experienced and very smart professor and practitioner. So I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
A terrific pleasure on my part. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.